Welcome to another episode of Undisciplined. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African and African American Studies program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF.
We'll be bringing you some of the best of what's happening in academia, taking it outside of the ivory towers, connecting it to what's buzzing in popular culture, and give you our take.
Taking the undisciplined approach of Africana studies outside of the classroom, into the community, and onto the airwaves, we invite you to share in research, ideas, movements of scholars and students, and members of Africa and the diaspora. I am your host, Dr. Karee Banton.
And I'm your co-host, Dr. Carrie Nisia Connor.
Let's get undisciplined! Well, welcome folks to another episode of the Undisciplined Podcast. I'm excited for you to join us for today's conversation. And today we have an exciting guest with us. He was born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee, in a community called Whitehaven. And he has written a book that's currently, you can get that on Amazon. He earned a scholarship to play football. Oh, multi-talented. At the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff. Oh, we used to beat y'all at Grambling. And then, you know, there he joined the campus newspaper team, the Arkansas-er. He transferred to Harding University after his sophomore year, and it was at Harding where he first picked up a video camera and his love for filmmaking was born. Vowing to return to his writing roots someday, he dove headfirst into the world of documentary filmmaking. He wrote and produced two independent documentary films, Islam in Arkansas and Street Stories. He has also served as a chief videographer and editor on several other feature-length documentary films, including the Emmy Award-winning documentary UNITY, produced in 2010. Mitchard Holliday is also an active member of the art community. He has served as an Arkansas Arts in Education instructor for the last 5 years. He travels the state teaching filmmaking to youth. Several organizations and schools, he has teamed up with organizations like the United Way, PBS, Thea Foundation, Titari Film School, Operation Military Kids, Arkansas 4-H, Ozarks Foothills Film Fest, and New Features and Youth Initiative Project in Little Rock. He has now traveled full circle. He's back to his writing, but also back to his filmmaking in full force. He's currently in the School of Education doing a PhD.
Yes.
And he is our guest today. Mitchard, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Benson. Thank you. You reminded me of some of these things I've done. And you're bringing back good memories.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. Thanks for having me.
Oh, wow. So who is Mitchard besides what you kind of put there on Google for us to see?
Oh, that's a great question. Like you said, I'm a filmmaker. I'm a writer. I'm a history buff. So I feel like I found my purpose when I've been able to mix the filmmaking with my writing and also tell stories that's not just important to me, but I think important for the world to know. So I'm a creative artist and I'm an academic. So I've coined a phrase called academic journalist. I don't know if that's a thing. If it's not a thing, I just coined it. So y'all give me my citations. But that's how
he
I feel.
Cite him.
Yes, cite me. I feel like I'm an academic journalist because I am doing this PhD, pursuing my PhD, and I'm doing this research, and I'm loving it. It's like every day I wake up excited to do this. It's not a drag. So an academic journalist, I guess I could sum myself, and an educator, all up in one.
Oh, my goodness. So whenever, as a historian, somebody tells me that they're a history buff.
Yes, I love it.
What is it you're buffing about in the history? What is it that tickles your fancy? What parts of history?
Well, particularly when you learn about things from your culture, that's very important. And it's history, a lot of it painful. It's not always exciting to learn about it, but you learn more about yourself. And not only that, you realize that once you, when you get to this point in life, you're standing on top of people. Like, yes. It's a lot of blood that's been
great
bled.
Great shoulders.
Yes, great shoulders. So the least I can do is to give back in that way and talk about these things. So when I'm learning these histories, I'm learning about myself. I'm learning about my ancestors, because you and I know it's a gap in our understanding.
Yeah.
And the more I learn, the more I learn. And I think it's important for us to share these things with the world.
And it's empowering, isn't it?
Oh, it's so empowering. It's so empowering.
It's like you unlock a different part of yourself every
right.
time you learn another, oh, he did that or she did that.
Right, right. And you just learn, like, you can put into context the things that's going on around you. So here I am in Arkansas, and I feel like it's like a smorgasbord, I guess I can say, of history. Black history, history that's important to America. And I'm learning every day. So, yes, it's empowering. It gives you purpose. And you feel like your ancestors are smiling on you.
Yeah, right. I love that. The ancestors are. I love when I think about them, like, oh, I did something that made them smile today. Like, I did something right that pushed the people forward, you know?
Exactly. And because they will come see you.
Oh, yeah.
They will come.
Haunt you.
It may sound esoteric, but they will come see you.
Right. So you are into documentary filmmaking.
Yes.
And, you know, what really made me ask you to come on this podcast is when we initially talked, I think when we first met, you talked to me about the project that you were working on. Could you tell the audience a little bit about that project?
Yes. So as part of my dissertation at the University of Arkansas, I am producing a documentary called The Educational Exodus. And basically what it's about educational reform in the southern United States, but specifically the Arkansas Delta. So when I was doing my research, first it started off, it was a circuitous path. It started off with, you know, the teacher attrition rate. But once I started looking into the teacher attrition rate, I saw the highest concentration of teacher attrition happens in the South. Particularly the black belt. Mm-hmm. And if the listeners don't know what the black belt is, it's like those 15 Confederate slave holding states from the Confederacy. So I looked at them, and so as the theory, you know, when you come up with theories, you always ask why. Mm-hmm. So one is why the highest attrition rate in the South. Mm-hmm. And then when you come to Arkansas specifically, the highest teacher attrition rate in Arkansas happens in the Arkansas Delta. Okay, so that made me ask a lot of questions. Why is it like this? And then you just kind of go down this rabbit hole of research and learning why, how did this community get this way? How did these school systems get this way? And the more you peel back layers, the more you find out. So what was it? In 2003, Sarah Huckabee, she came with the Arkansas Learns.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's the Learns Act.
The Learns Act, the Arkansas Learns Act. So as part of that Act, the state signed a transformation contract with the Marvel Elaine school system that allows a private charter management company to come in and run the school district. So that's another question. I'm like, why?
So you're connecting the dot. You're
connecting
synthesizing.
The dot. I'm synthesizing.
Ah, look at you out here. All right. So, okay, you have your research question,
mm-hmm.
and you went down into the Delta, and you're talking to folks, and you're looking at data and information.
Yes.
And so tell us a little bit about what you're discovering and how you're making sense of it.
Well, as part of my documentary, I'm working with a family. It's a young lady named Jessela Maples. She's a community activist, and she has kids in the Marvel Elaine School District. So what I'm finding is that they feel unempowered. They feel like that they could have made these changes themselves. A lot of times when outside people or companies come in and try to fix the system, you take away local control. So I'm finding that the community comes together, a great community. They are trying to maintain control over their school system, but they're also open to options as well. So I'm just finding, like, they feed me good. It's probably, I hope they don't make me biased. They hugging me, they encouraging me, but I see a community that's very invested in their community. They're invested in their children, and they're self-reflecting as well. So it's just still good people that wants the best for their community, but they want to have a say-so. They don't want to stand on the sidelines and solve this problem. And a lot of them do feel that they wasn't part of the conversation when these changes was being made. So I'm finding all that out. And, of course, I'm eating good. I'm picking up weight. Way too much food.
Oh, dear. Wow.
Right.
But you're also, in your project, per our discussion, you try to connect what you're describing as this massive educator exodus, right?
Yes,
that
yes.
is plaguing the public school system.
Right.
All these teachers leaving. We
right.
saw what happened in West Virginia.
Right.
You know, the massive teacher fallout and all the protests and all of that kind of stuff. It's kind of interesting now that Tim Walz is a teacher and
yes.
he's on the ballot. So
right.
that should be fascinating new information for you. But you tried to connect this to the Southern Exodus?
Yes. So when you get to the South, you understand my idea as I dug into the Exodus, it expanded. So it's just not teacher attrition, it's resource attrition. So once you go back in history, you learn, like, after Brown v. Board of Education, the white flight happened. But so when that happens, that take students, that take resources, that take money and educators out of the area. Even before that, you have Painter V, where a lot of Southern people, that was a higher education case
mm-hmm.
where they deemed, like, separate, unequal. So it was, even though it didn't happen in public education, they could see the writing on the wall. So you had a mass exodus then. So when I started talking about the education exodus, I had to expand my vision just from teachers leaving to resources leaving. And then you kind of trace those things back to when this stuff originally happened. So you have several exodus that happened. And like I said, it's more than just teachers. It's resources. It's money and everything that contribute to this community in the state that it's in now.
Wow. So I want us to reflect on that Painter versus the Sweat versus Painter.
Yes.
Court case, because that was one of two case precedents
yes.
that you kind of referred to. And if our guests are not quite familiar with those, then we want them to understand, right?
Yes.
What they were, right? So can you talk a little bit about those cases?
It was a higher education case that can't remember the name of the university now, but it was basically, it wasn't like separate. The separate entities wasn't, it was the separate but equal. So you had a black plaintiff that's trying to go to school. And in those cases, this court ruled that the quality of education that they were getting wasn't equal. So once they ruled against that in the Supreme Court, that set the precedent for Brown v. Board of Education, because they saw it happen in a higher education, so they knew it was just time for it to become a public education thing.
Yeah, so I think for a lot of our listeners, they are quite familiar with the NAACP. They know the NAACP was created around the early 20th century, around 1908, in response to a riot in Springfield, Illinois. And people like Du Bois and Mary Church Terwell and so on were a big part of that. And then the NAACP came to play a big role in the civil rights movement, and they had a strategy.
Mm-hmm.
They had a strategy. I think what people know of the strategy is Brown versus the Board of Education
right, right.
and our boy. Thurgood.
Thurgood, right.
Thurgood Marshall, that, you know, became a Supreme Court justice. But that what they may not know is just the string of court cases that, you know, led up to Brown versus Board of Education.
Right.
One of which was Sweat versus Painter, S-W-E-A-T-T. The ruling basically said that an all-black law school, which was established in Texas, was in violation of the 14th Amendment because
right.
the facilities were unequal.
Yes, yes.
You know?
Exactly.
And the same thing happened in McLaurin versus Oklahoma State Regents,
yes.
where the University of Oklahoma graduate student George McLaurin his constitutional rights were violated when he was denied equal access to the classrooms, dining halls, and the library. Many of our guests who are probably from Arkansas are probably familiar with Silas Hunt.
Right.
They probably know that the University of Arkansas was one of the first to integrate in the South and so on. But these two court cases were extremely significant. And you talk about their significance in reference to the 14th Amendment. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it set the precedent that separate in the South, separate wasn't equal. Mm-hmm. So you had separate. Of course, we lived up until then. We lived under Jim Crow, and there were separate facilities, but there wasn't always equal. So that 14th Amendment was a violation, and that's what the Supreme Court deemed it a violation. So, like I said before, that set the precedent for Brown v. that separate wasn't equal in the South. You had these separate facilities, but you didn't get the same kind of blacks couldn't get the same kind of access to quality education, quality materials. And the Supreme Court saw fit to say that separate wasn't equal in those cases in the South.
Yeah, indeed. Right. In terms of thinking about, given that you had those three fundamental amendments passed after the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, and because it was more difficult to really get rid of an amendment, you know, they came up with a separate but equal.
Right, yes, yes.
Right? So we can't get rid of the amendment. It's like, well, you can't really force us because they have equal facilities
over
there.
Yes, yes.
But what you're saying is those facilities were not really equal.
Yes, they wasn't equal. And once the Supreme Court looked into that, they saw that it just wasn't equality. So they had to force that separate but equal clause.
Okay, wonderful. So the 14th Amendment figured significantly in these cases. So you are arguing that these cases, McLaurin as well as Sweat, that they're setting a precedent for the landmark Brown versus the Board of Education Supreme Court decision.
Right. So those decisions were made in the higher education. People, especially in the South, they could see the writing on the wall. They knew something was happening, and so that's when you got your first kind of mass exodus away from public schools. A lot of private schools popped up during those times, and this was preceding Brown v. Board of Education, because, like I said, once that ruling came down, they knew what was happening in public schools. So you had your educational exodus, your first exodus, and you saw resources, people leaving. You saw a private school boom all over the South. And that was...
So there's a model established.
Yes, it's a model and a precedent that was established. And like I said, they could see the writing on the wall. So they was preparing themselves for what was going to happen on down the road with public schools.
Mm-hmm. So in this recent... case, you're saying that we had this early precedent where Brown versus Board, and we're going to have integration. We're seeing the proliferation of private schools. Is any of this recent public school massive educator exodus, besides the how it affects maybe black teachers, are there issues of like that are more fundamental to how we understood that early period of integration that you see going on as well?
Yeah, so what do you see right now is educational reform, and that's basically what I'm focused on, is how educational reform affects Southern schools, but definitely Southern rural schools. So now you have like universal vouchers. You have all of these charter schools, the charter school boom, and all of these things came about. It's almost like a 360, because once forced integration, I guess you can call it, like once Brown v. hit, you saw a lot of Southern legislators coming up with these educational reforms to kind of fight against integration. Mm-hmm. That's when you saw the private school boom. That's when you saw...
That's when you see tuition hikes as a kind of way to get people from like going into colleges and things like that.
Right, tuition hikes. And you hear this rhetoric, you start hearing this rhetoric for the first time of freedom of choice, mm-hmm. freedom of choice school, and all of that was basically a blowback against forced integration. So they took it out of, like, you know, physically, like the physical realm of society, and they took it to the politics. Mm-hmm. So now you're hearing some of the same rhetoric, like freedom of choice, school choice. Basically, when it started in the South, it was to kind of maintain this separate mm-hmm. and the fight against integration. So now you see, like, neoliberalism, which is this free market ideology,
right,
which pertained to schools. Mm-hmm. You heard this right after Brown v. So a lot of the educational reform legislation that's happened in the South has, in my eyes, through my research, has been kind of to fight against forced integration. And that goes back to Brown v. Board of Education.
Wow, that's interesting. But, Mashad, you know, I talked to my cousin in Atlanta recently, and she's very enthusiastic about setting up, like, an all-male boarding school. And she's all for all of the school reform stuff.
Right.
You know, she's like, fine, we can take our vouchers and we can take money and go set up our own schools and teach our own history. And sure, they can go wherever they want to go and we can go. What is wrong with that?
I don't think anything. I'm not all the way against school choice. I'm not all the way against charter schools, because I taught in the public school system. And a lot of our black kids, especially our black boys, they suffering. So I'm all about, like, positive things to kind of help this problem. So I'm not all the way against charter schools. What I'm against is when you take away school systems, public school systems in small rural towns like Marva Elaine, mm-hmm. it's you take away, like, the lifeblood of the community.
Ah.
So those public schools are very, very important to those smaller communities. So you have the mending of Marva Elaine, two school systems. So what happened to the Elaine school system? They took the schools away. The Public Reorganization Act of 2005 said if you have 350 or less students in your school system, then the state can come and, you know, consolidate your school system. But, you know, I was in Elaine last weekend. I looked, and the population of Elaine is only 300 people. So it's impossible for a lot of those communities to come up with that. So it's like self-fulfilling prophecies of failure.
Yeah.
So communities like that, the public school system is way more important than just grades and statistics. When you take away business, you take away those Friday games, you take away the community and the money that was flowing into the community, and a lot of times these small towns, they die.
Right.
So it's not a one-size-fits-all for the entire country. I believe that, like I said, I worked in the school system. So I want to come up with a choice, because our kids, a lot of our kids are suffering. They're not getting what they want. It's just sometimes charter schools can come in, and they don't have to abide by all the rules that public schools does. And a lot of, you know, public schools have to take everybody, all type of kids, special mm-hmm. needs and everything. A lot of times charter schools could come in and just cherry pick.
Right.
And
so they can really re-inscribe some of the discriminatory practices that had been outlawed.
Exactly.
Because now it's operating under market forces.
Right. So if everything was even, I'm all about it. But let's invest into our public schools, too, because a lot of these smaller communities, they don't have that choice just to take their kids and go to another school district or go to a school district that's not failing. Let's figure out why these school districts are failing, and let's put that local control back to these communities' hand, because I know when it was, you know, when black kids go to school with black teachers in the black community, they do get loved better. They do achieve more. Than when somebody on the outside comes and tries to fix it.
This is research.
Yes, this is data-driven research. So I'm not totally against charter schools. I'm not totally against it, but it's not a one-size-fits-all for all communities.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about You said that there was another school exodus that happened in Little Rock, Arkansas in 57.
Well, after Brown v., you had like a private school boom after like that integration, those integration orders came down. So that's when you had the biggest like private school boom. But back then, public funds wasn't being used for these private institutions.
So is that the game changer?
That's
then?
The game changer. Now you have in Marvel Elaine, now you have a outside private company that can use public funds to come take over a private, a public school district. And that used to didn't be that way. Private schools always had tax advantages, but they wasn't using public funds to kind of allow students to choose private institutions. And that's how it is with the new vouchers now. They can take our, you know, public tax dollars and send their students to private schools. You can send them to charter schools. But this new precedence of using public funds just kind of became a thing within the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people are speculating, you know, the conspiracy theorists might exist out there where they're suggesting that all of these cell schools and home schools and things like that that happened during COVID, right, where people did admit what for whatever religious belief or, you know, all kinds of different beliefs that may have, like, sunk money into, you know, having those schools. And now they're using the public purse to then recoup those dollars.
Yes, that's one of the things that's happening now is even families that can afford it, they're using these funds to kind of recoup those costs. So you have – so research telling me this in this last year, a lot of the well-to-do families are using these vouchers to kind of, you know, offset their income and still be able to send these schools, their students to private schools. But now they're getting state funds or public funds to do it now. And these are families that were already in the private school system. So you have this rollout where the powers to be that will tell you that, okay, yeah, this is going to help, you know, the poor or you know, low-income kids. They roll it out that way, but when it happens, the people that were already benefiting, they still benefit, and the people, the families that should benefit from it, you don't see them benefiting as more.
But how much of this is kind of related to just how school funding is structured in the United States? Could you break that down for the audience? Because I think that was one of the things that I struggled to wrap my head around. Like, you know, in becoming American, it was one of the things that I'm like, what?
Right.
How does that go?
So a small percentage of the money comes from the feds, of course. The largest percent for school districts come from the state as well. And then property taxes pays a big chunk of it. But if you have poverty-ridden communities, you're not going to have as high as property taxes as you do in, you know, well-to-do communities. So it's almost like a cycle of failure. These communities, they're relying on property taxes, but if the property tax is not there, it's like they can't pull themselves out of this poverty or they can't pull themselves out of this failure because they're relying so much on property taxes. The Fed pays maybe 3-5%, and most of it comes from the state. So when they talk about giving local control back to the communities or states, those funds are not making it to where they need to make it.
But it's like, you know, this seems like it's, this is the sine die for America, right? In terms of the tales of race and class and all of those different kinds of things, because I'm sure there's some folks who could, you know, say that if you want your school to do better, then improve your property, improve yourself. But so many people in America rely on education to escape their condition.
Yes, exactly.
You know, which brings me to probably what this episode is all about, really. In America, what is education for?
Well, as I read this history, I know how much it meant to our ancestors. It used to be, and it should still be, a way that you can improve your life. It was the way for the masses to become educated and change their situations for the better. That was the democratic principle that it was set on. And in my mind, when you see a lot of these, you know, charter schools or private schools popping up and getting public funds, they don't have to stick to that original democratic principle of free universal education for everybody to make your situation better. So the further we get away from those public schools, we get away from that democratic promise. And in America, that's one of the things that this whole country was built. That's one of the best things that we did. It's a shining example of the world, is to have this free universal education for everybody.
It's a whole idea of, like, how do you lift yourself up by your bootstrap? Yes. If not by education, and, you know, how do you even equip yourself with the tools to get work, to lift yourself up out of poverty?
Yes. And it was, like I said, the public school system are still connected to that idea, that democratic idea. And if you go to a free market, which I understand the market and I understand business, but one thing I do know about business is it's about the numbers. It's about the bottom line. And when you're dealing with children and students and lives, we're more complicated than that. We're more than a number. And if you break education down to just a number, a lot of people still gonna miss out, because, you know, basically they're preparing you just to work a job or work for a corporation, and you're not being dealt with as an entity.
Stay tuned for more on discipline after this commercial break.
I'm Denisha Simpson.
And I'm Joy McGowan.
And we are the co-host to the Resilient Black Women podcast. Our podcast is all about demystifying mental health for Black women, women of color, and women everywhere.
You can learn more about our work with our nonprofit and our podcast by visiting resilientblackwomen.org.
You can also listen to our podcast at KUAF.com or subscribe to our podcast on any streaming platform.
Welcome back.
Hello.
Nice to meet you again.
Nice to meet you too. I'm glad I finally made it into the studio. I got a crazy story for y'all.
All right.
Yes.
Can't wait to hear that.
Man, this LearnZack. So you've been going around what parts of Arkansas collecting stories for your documentary?
Well, I'm focused on the Arkansas Delta, particularly the Phillips County, where the Marvel Elaine school system, they have this transformation contract with the state that they signed back in 2003, which allows outside charter management company to come in and take over the school district. So basically that's what my focus is.
So what are you finding with your participants in your documentary series? What are they saying about this partnership?
Well, the main person that I'm following is a young lady named Jessela Maples. So she, when they first signed the transformation contract, she was a part of the lawsuit against Arkansas Learn, saying that it was unconstitutional because Arkansas Learn hadn't gone into effect. It wasn't going to go into effect until that August. And I think they signed the contract in that May. So she was part of the initial lawsuit that said, hold up, y'all taking away local control away from us. We can do this ourselves. Mm-hmm. So that skepticism was there. I went back and talked to her this past weekend, and she was a little less skeptical. You know,
skeptical?
Yeah, she's a little less skeptical about the charter management company, because they did come in and have like a literacy night with the community. So she's a little less skeptical, but she still wants to preserve that local control and wondering how long this was going to be, and hopefully they're not going to set up permanently in the community.
Right, right. So she is a community member, a student, a parent, or a part of the school district?
She's a community member, a parent of four kids in the district, and an activist for the community.
Okay. And so, but the way the LEARNS Act stated that provision, that the school districts that were failing would partner with charter schools, or it seemed like it was more of a suggestion than an actual mandate. Is it a mandate?
Right. Yes, it was a mandate. And she also feel like that the community didn't have enough say into this beforehand. It seems like, you know, one day they woke up, she said they thought they was doing well, and one day they woke up, the state was taking over, and next day they woke up, they had this transformation contract with an outside entity. So she doesn't feel the community was given enough, you know, say-so in this decision.
And that's so often the story when these school transformation, in Texas they call it school turnaround,
right?
Where the state sends state mandated managers to go into a district or a school and turn it around rapidly, very fast, having no clue about the cultural contingencies of the community, what they need, what their history has been, what their students need. And so as you're following this person in your documentary, what are some of the things that you're seeing? Like, what's been surprising to you so far?
Well, it was surprising to me that the community wasn't consulted much. And also their meetings, their monthly meetings, they're held in Little Rock. And that's,
what?
Yes, that's like.
How far is that?
About 2.5 hours away from the community. So their meetings are held in Little Rock. So that was shocking to me. But what's been beautiful is what you said earlier, is because if I get to dig into the history. If you don't understand the community, it's hard for you to help the community. So you have to understand the history behind it. You got to understand what the community has been through and the mind state of the people. And that's been the best thing. Is I've given the people that live there a voice.
So let's stick a pin there, because you're talking about the history of the community. And Karenicia said something just now about the cultural component.
Yes.
You did say Elaine, right?
Yes, it's Marva Elaine, but yes, Elaine, definitely. Yes.
So, I mean, our guests know the name Elaine.
Right.
We know that it was site of one of the biggest racial massacres.
Yes, 1919.
Right here in Arkansas.
Yes.
How are people like taking up this trauma like into this current moment with the education?
Yes, they're still around. The mayor, I went and interviewed the mayor earlier this summer, and she said something that struck me. She grew up in the Elaine community, but she said she didn't even learn about the Elaine race massacre till she was in her 40s.
That's, I just found out today.
Really?
Today, years old.
Oh.
Thank y'all.
That was amazing. She's the mayor down there now, so that was amazing to me. She said, and I asked her why, but the fear that was instilled, especially in the black community down there, it was so deep that she said her grandma or her mom them never told her about it.
It's the same thing with Tulsa as well.
Yes.
People did not want to bring that. I mean, you know, when trauma happens to you, you don't really want to talk about
it.
Right.
And you don't want to burden your children with that going forward. So, you know, it's like how sometimes some Hispanic families don't want their kids to learn Spanish because it's been used against them.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, lots of them buried that deep. But I'm sure it's coming back up very strong now.
Yes, she's working on initiative now where she's opening the Elaine Race Massacre Museum, and they may not be the specific name, but she's doing like freedom rides. I'm going down there and do a freedom ride with her, and she's just bringing this history back to the forefront. And that's why I feel so blessed to be able to do this as well, because this is buried history that's important, not only important to African Americans, it's important to the world. And to get it swept.
To our memory.
Yes, and to understand the context of what we're living in today. So for it to be swept under the rug, it's a very important part of American history that I think we need to keep alive.
I think it's interesting to discuss those type of events in tandem with public education and really contributing towards our distrust or mistrust for institutional innovation, they might call it, or renewal. But your interviewee or in your docuseries, who you're following, restate their name for me again.
Jessela Maples.
Jessela?
Yes.
Jessela Maples. So is she kind of like learning this process of challenging the school district by trial and error, or is this something that she already has like this information and knowledge?
No, she comes from a long line on both sides of her family of educators. So her mom was superintendent of, if I'm not mistaken, the Parkin school system. She's not an educator herself, but she's been around educators her whole entire life. So she understands. And like I said, she's picking up the mantle for this generation of, you know, young black people to kind of keep it going, because she feel like it's important as well. But no, she's come from both sides of educators.
But it's quite interesting, if we could go back to Elaine, for just a minute, and to think about how that racial mask occur and what is happening now with the mandate being issued by the state for the takeover, right?
Right.
So our listeners may have known, I think, you know, lots of these things been circulating in the zeitgeist that Elaine in 1919 was by far the deadliest racial confrontation in Arkansas and possibly the bloodiest.
Wow.
And that the state, it recently the University of Arkansas removed Governor Bruff's name from one of the buildings because he was implicated in that racial massacre. And this happened in Phillips County around Elaine, and it stemmed from the tense race relations growing around labor unions where sharecroppers, African-American sharecroppers, were vowing to unionize, right? The Progressive Farmers and Household Union. And they gathered inside a building and they sent people in there. They shot and they defended themselves and then they just unleashed, you know, a bloody bath on them. And so, you know, a whole bunch of African-American sharecroppers were killed that night. But it seemed like because they got the go ahead from on high from the governor.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so now the go ahead is coming also from high from the state too. So it's a similar kind of power dynamic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where they're being taken, they're being robbed of their agency, right? And some people who don't know their community is coming in to do a one size fits all for everyone.
Right.
New form of racial violence.
Right.
intellectual mask.
Yes.
At this point.
Yeah. Right. It's disenfranchisement is what you call
it.
Right.
Right. Right. Right. Right. So you are connecting that history, you know, with this current teacher exodus.
Yes.
How do you sum all of that up for us now? What kind of conclusions are you drawing?
Well, it seems like with the new educational reform and the history of educational reform, it seems to try to make, it still seems like it's a fight against integration. It seemed like it's still trying to maintain separation of races, to be honest with you.
Really?
So all subsequent legislation you've seen after Brown v. has seemed to me in the South has been to maintain it.
Well, Nicole Hannah-Jones taught us that schools are more segregated now today than they were at Brown.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And even me talking to Jessela, she still goes back to that 2005, you know, Public Education Reformation Act that was signed into law by the former Governor Huckabee that said, okay, if your school district drops under 350 students for 2 years, then you can be consolidated or the state can take over. And she still cites that because, like I said earlier, these are smaller communities. It's going to be hard for them to get 350 students. Why can't we come up with a different solution than state takeover or consolidation? And if you bring, you know, private money or, you know, private versus public funds in it, are these communities being preyed on because they are vulnerable, because they are poor?
You make a good point.
So it's easier for those communities to be taken over. And when I saw the Transformation Act and I saw where it was first being signed, that was another question. Like, okay, why?
It's not a form of gentrification.
It is. It's a form of gentrification.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, we saw that in Chicago. We saw it in New York.
I didn't even know this was happening in New York.
It started happening
until
in Kentucky. And it's happening in the South now, too.
Yes.
You know, and it's starting in rural communities of color where this turnaround transformation is then being a new way to kind of recompose demographics in these areas.
Right, right. And it did happen in Little Rock. The state took over and got rid of, you know, the majority black school board. I think this happened maybe in 2017. Don't quote me on that, but it's the same kind of disenfranchisement where you have a majority black school board finally, and then they can say, come in and just, you know, take over, and, you know, one person takes over their school district, which is not.
And now there's over like 90 private schools with the Learns Act, right?
Yes.
That have popped up in Little Rock alone.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, the Learns Act is supposed to be for giving priority to students who are at F-rated schools, yes, and then D-rated schools, to then be able to use public funds to go to private schools and give them school choice. But in 2023-2024 school year, only 1% of the population of those people who were enrolled in those private schools to get those funds came from an F-rated school.
Yes, exactly. Oh,
wow. It's quite interesting.
Yes.
It's quite interesting.
And a lot of time, those communities and that demographic, on the front end, they are used to kind of get the public to accept these things. But in reality, it doesn't make it to the people that need to make it.
They feed it because that's the lexicon that the public understands, right? They understand we have a history of race. We have a history of associating with Black people, with not doing well in certain kinds of areas. But I'm wondering, in the same way, you know, one of my former students from Little Rock, Eric Hughes, that studies highways and studied the Little Rock Highway I-630 and how that was used to destroy the Black community. Yes. I'm wondering if 50 years from now we will be studying how this educational bill, right, because of its effect on these kind of poor and low income community with no kind of input from them, it would have destroyed the community. Will we see another great migration, or, you know, the community kind of disperse because they're losing control, you know, in this way?
Right. In these small rural towns, they're dying. That's why I was in Elaine taking pictures and videos. Like, once you take the public school away, the town dies.
Oh, wow.
The community.
The community dies. Mm-hmm. That's right. The community dies.
Oh, wow. Well, you've taught us something very sobering today.
Indeed, indeed. Right. It's a conversation that we all need to be a part of, whether you have children in the school or not, if this is happening in your community or not. And, you know, more than relying on equitable structures to invite us in fairly, we need to learn about how to participate in these structures in ways that are considered legitimate by these structures, and to get inside and transform them on our behalf.
Yes, right. I totally agree.
And just as somebody who is not in education, so you guys could learn me something. you know, who are some of the folks that listeners could follow to kind of get more credible academic information on these kinds of research, you know, that's going on in the academy? Does anyone quickly come to mind?
Well, I get a lot of my information from the journalists. This is really a journalist-driven topic because it's happening right now. Yeah, so pay attention to journalism. Journalism is not dead. Journalism is very, very important.
As I mentioned, Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's one of the foremost that recently took her talents to Howard University.
Right, right. Yeah. And I'm reading a book right now, I think, about Noli Rooks, and it's called it's about Segronomics, and basically, you know, the money-fication of public schools now. So just check out some authors, check out the journalists. They're like really keeping their finger on the pulse of this thing going forward.
I agree. That's where I got that figure about the 1%.
Right, yeah. Journalism, and I consider myself an academic journalist, and I'll keep my finger on it as well.
You know, right. They're on the ground. They're in touch with the community. They're talking to the people. They're providing nuanced perspectives of this.
They are.
You know, I think an academic perspective is great, but I think a journalist perspective of those who are interacting with the community and really seeing the changes as they become more tangible and visceral and visible are providing really good insights. So I agree.
So true.
Well, there you have it, from the people in education themselves telling you what's up, what's popping on the education circuit, you know. Thank you all for listening to another episode of Undisciplined Today, and hope you'll join us next time.
Right. See ya.
Thanks for having me.
Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African and African American Studies Program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF.
The podcast provides a peek into the complex issues that affects our interconnected world.
Taking the interdisciplinary approach of African and African American studies to the classroom, into the community, onto the airwaves, and beyond, we expose you to the studies, the thoughts of university scholars, students, and members of the African and the African diaspora communities.
It is hosted by Dr. Karee Benton and Dr. Karenicia Connor. It is produced by Leah Grant. It's available every other Wednesday at KUAF.com, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Follow the African and African-American Studies program and the Undisciplined podcast on Instagram at UARKAASD or visit KUAF.com to listen to all episodes.